Transportation Committee. Today is May 27th, 2015. Senator Beyer is tied up with the transportation package, so I'll be conducting the meeting today. I'm just letting people know House Bill 2832 will not be heard today. House Bill 3414 will not be heard today. And House Bill 2567. So let me repeat that one more time. I don't want people sitting out there that don't need to be. House Bill 2832 will not be heard today. House Bill 3414 will not be heard today. And House Bill 2567 will not be heard today. We're going to open a hearing, a public hearing, on House Bill 3317. We have Representative Taylor and Kenemer. And I think they wanted to invite somebody up to the dais with them. Okay, Jack Roberts. Okay.
Mr. Vice Chair, committee members, House Bill 33117A requires report on the quantity and location of video lottery retailers from Oregon State Lottery by October 1st of each numbered year in coordination with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Defines socioeconomic status. There's no revenue impact, and there's a minimal fiscal impact, and there are no amendments.
Okay, go ahead, Representative Taylor. Nice to have you here.
Thank you, Vice Chair Girard and members of the committee. I'm Kathleen Taylor, State Representative, House District 41. Thank you for hearing House Bill 3317 today, which directs the Oregon State Lottery to report on the distribution and concentration of video lottery game terminals in relation to measures of socioeconomic status of neighborhoods where they are located. This is a simple bill that stems from conversations Representative Kenemer and I have had with lottery officials, problem gambling specialists, and others. We know where all the lottery terminals are located. Anecdotally, we think many are in low-income neighborhoods or areas with high unemployment, but we have no actual facts. House Bill 3317 will provide us with that data. For a little background, problem gambling is a serious issue here in Oregon. Over 80,000 Oregon adults have gambling problems. Most Oregonians in gambling treatment prefer Oregon lottery games. The Oregon Council on Problem Gambling estimates the economic costs associated with problem gambling to Oregonians is between $330 million and $600 million annually. That's between $660 million and $1.2 billion for the biennium, about the same amount of revenue that the lottery actually provides. I've posted on OLIS a fact sheet detailing additional demographic data. Pathological gamblers suffer a high degree of shame and embarrassment. Gambling problems often come to light only after marriages dissolve, retirement savings are squandered, and child welfare is endangered or law enforcement becomes involved. One in four gamblers experience serious job-related problems. One in 10 attempt suicide. So what, if anything, should we do? House Bill 3317 will actually help gather facts. It will help us determine what the characteristics are of the neighborhoods where these terminals are located. It will help us identify where we should target additional outreach efforts. It will also help us identify if there are mitigating strategies we could employ to help reduce problem gambling. We've talked with Lottery Director Jack Roberts, researchers at Oregon State University, and folks at Oregon GIS. They can correlate data from the U.S. Census American Community Survey with current lottery information, and it will be easy to provide this neighborhood analysis. The governor's office supports this measure, and it passed with the House with an overwhelming bipartisan support. I urge you to move forward with this bill with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kenemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Bill Kenemer, State Representative from Canby and portions of Clackamas County. And thank you for holding this hearing on House Bill 3317A. This is an interesting and important topic to me, this whole issue of gambling and the lottery. I served in the Senate in the previous century, and when the lottery was just getting underway. And was supportive of the lottery, but began quickly to have concerns about the expansion of the lottery. And as you know professionally, I'm a psychologist, and one of the things that is of concern to me on a personal and professional level is addiction. And certainly, I think that's the history of gambling and the history of the lottery is there are certain members of the public that are addicted to our machines, and also, frankly, we as the legislature, I'm afraid, are likely addicted to the profits. And I think, like a lot of things in life, it reminds me of alcohol. It's something that you can't eliminate, and I'm not sure that you would want to. On the other hand, I think one of the things that we lack is balance. And since returning to the House, I worked first with Representative Tomei, and now I'm glad to be working with Representative Taylor and lots of other people in trying to discuss, let's have some balance in the system. And one of the concerns is related specifically to 3317, and that is that it's long been my view that the lottery is essentially a poor tax. That it's my belief, not confirmed by evidence at this point, that largely the poor people in our society are the ones who are putting the substantial amounts of money into the lottery. And it's interesting, Sherry and I have a favorite little bar that we enjoy going to, Chinese food on McLaughlin Boulevard. And we sit in the bar and we watch these people on Fridays, and it's a very sad thing because they start out with $20, and then they start hitting the cash machine, and a lot of them spend a lot of time there, and you know they're spending more than they can really afford to spend. And one of the suppositions that has come from that, as we as a group have looked at this, is, well, these are in poor areas and probably more prevalent in poor areas, which facilitates easy access and then excessive gambling. The problem is we don't know the facts about that. And so we came up with the idea of let's start getting some demographic data and see if our assumptions are accurate and how these are distributed and whether or not there is a pattern and whether or not the lottery maybe has, and we being charged with working in the best interests of the public, have a responsibility to maybe make some adjustments in where these are located and how many are located in different areas, and perhaps we'll discover other things from the data. Part of the research in my PhD, part of the background in my PhD was in research, and I find lots of times if we have good data, we can get some answers that we don't readily find otherwise. So I'm looking forward to this and would love to have your support, and am delighted to have the director of the lottery here with us today, and I think he will explain we also have support of the governor, which we're very grateful for.
Okay. Jack, go ahead.
Thank you. For the record, Jack Roberts, the director of the Oregon Lottery. And it is true that in the when the bill was before the House, the direction from the governor's office was for us to remain neutral as an agency. And we just got the word yesterday that we're now allowed to support this. What I can tell you is that from the beginning I've been intrigued at the idea because I think it's extremely important that we make decisions based on data, and trying to collect this data and correlate that we think is something that is very easy to do and something that we would welcome the opportunity to do. And in fact, as I pointed out before, we actually don't need additional authorization, and we would be glad to go forward and do it anyway. But I appreciate Representative Taylor and Representative Kinnemer pushing this forward to get the legislature's attention, that I think it is important that we look at data and make decisions based on that. Now, having said that, I don't necessarily expect that we're going to find some of the evidence that others believe that we will see, and I think that what's going to be at least as important as collecting the right data is making sure that we evaluate it correctly and we understand what the implications of it mean. As I think you all know, we are required by law only to place the video lottery machines where we have OLCC license of one of four varieties. And so basically it's going to be in restaurants, bars, and taverns. And what's not a proposed part of this bill, but one of the things that could help distribute that better is if you'd pass a law that required upper-end, high-end restaurants to have video lottery machines, it would help us a lot. But it's for some reason.
Speaking for himself.
For yeah, I mean, I'm being facetious there, obviously. not surprisingly, that's not a place that, that usually is opening their arms to welcome us and our facility. So we're trying very hard to improve our brand. We'd rather be in places that have a more positive image, but by the same token, places that do serve families, and they're not as inclined to welcome us for reasons that we understand and support. So getting the data will help us in trying to decide how we can better make sure that we're targeting not only the market that provides the revenue that we all rely on for the lottery, but also how we can do it in ways that are socially responsible. And so that's why we think that collecting this data would be valuable.
Any questions, Senator Ryder?
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Oh,
excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that I'm supportive of this bill and supportive of gathering data. I always want to see as much data as possible on anything that we regulate. One of the things I want to see from this is what it shows us about those places who are lottery shops and have a little bit of food or a little bit of drink because they have to be a lottery shop. And we have a lot of those. And I think if you want to improve your vision out in the community about how people think about it, those places are the things you want to look at.
I wish to respond.
Thank you. I think that's a good point. I think a lot of things are going to come out. And I just realized I forgot to add the final piece to my comments, and that is. The Oregonian is in the process of examining some similar kinds of data and have been kind enough to share it with me. I haven't had time yet to go through it. But, you know, one of the discoveries that they found is, lo and behold, there are more bars in low-income areas than there are in others, and it's akin to the restaurant discussion. And I think it lends credence to my hypothesis that it's a problem more in lower-income areas, but that's why we need to do the research, and then I think we can make some appropriate adjustments. And I think there are other issues of image, and it'll be fun to see how people perceive us, and perhaps this will give us some other ideas about how to proceed.
Any follow-up or any other questions?
Yep.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. You. Appreciate the time.
Okay, I'm going to call three people up together here. Sharon Williams, Wes Wood, and Nigel, I think it's Corbin.
Were you nice to Kathleen?
No. Yes.
She's on our subcommittee, so that's pretty good.
Okay, Sharon, why don't you were the first one to sign up, so if you don't mind, you can start us off.
Okay. I was trying to pass it off to Nicole, but...
Oh, that's fine.
No, I'm teasing.
Okay.
I'm good. thank you, Chair and Senators, for listening to us today. My name is Sharon Williams, and I am a member of Voices of Problem Gambling Recovery. I also have other roles that I do. One of them is that I am a recovering gambler. I haven't gambled for quite a few years. But I've been where some of these folks are that are entering treatment, and I know what that's like, and I'm a person that tries to help in whatever way I can to get people to the right place. So I'm very supportive of the treatment efforts and the work that's been done around problem gambling. So that's about me. Okay. Problem gambling in Oregon affects more than 80,000 people. That was stated by representative. And one thing that's important about that is that most of those people, about 75% of those, play video lottery poker machines or terminals. And there's also a disproportionate amount of folks that spend the most money. And as was mentioned before, some of those folks are from lower income communities or families. So there's I think there is data to be had, and I really support doing anything that will take us in the direction of getting information so that we can not only can the lottery do their job, but the people that are trying to help the problem gambler can be better prepared to do their job as well. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you. I'm going to just go through the whole panel, then we'll open it up for questions. So, okay. Wes Wood?
Sure. Thank you, Chair, committee members. My name is Wes Wood. I'm a director of public relations for Voice of Problem Gambling Recovery. We are a 501c3 nonprofit. Our work is to advocate and to educate and to promote healthy recovery from problem gambling. What we try to do is facilitate people to access to treatment, their families as well. We're well aware of the devastation that compulsive gambling brings to the families and to their careers. We're also very well aware of the charge of the Oregon Lottery and its mission, which is asked of it by the citizens and the government. This bill is about many elements. It's about transparency, and it's about responsibility, and it's about the partnership between public and state government and the Oregon Lottery, and it's about being proactive. And that's at all levels. It's about acknowledging that regardless of the changes within the lottery, its commission, its director, or its leadership, the public can know that the level of expectation will include the intended accountability. It's also about being smarter about how we choose to do business in Oregon. The mistakes made earlier in times do not have to be what defines this period for us, and that includes maximizing the revenues for the state of Oregon. If the unintended consequences are too much at any level, we must be prepared to seek a solution, navigate the resolution, and implement a healthier path on behalf of all Oregonians. I support this bill. It's just clean bookkeeping. Thank you. Thanks for your time.
Go ahead.
Vice Chair Girard, members of the committee, I apologize for my terrible handwriting. I'm Nicole Corbin.
I'm sorry for the way I pronounced it.
I'll take the blame for that one. I'm Nicole Corbin. I'm the Addiction Services Manager with the Oregon Health Authority Addictions and Mental Health Division. I'm here to provide information on House Bill 3317A, which directs the Oregon State Lottery Commission and OLCC to report biennially on the distribution of video lottery game terminals in relation to socioeconomic status. As you have heard from some of my fellow panel members and from Representative Taylor and Kinnemer, problem gambling is a significant public health concern. In Oregon in particular, we have more legal ways to gamble than virtually any other state. And access to gambling has continued to expand in Oregon over the past 20 years. Because of this growth in accessibility, it's critical to mitigate the risks and consequences that are associated with problem gambling. Several of my colleagues have mentioned that the penetration rate of about 2% of Oregonians means that more than 80,000 adults in Oregon are problem gamblers. I think it's also important to remember that each disordered gambler has a spouse or a child or an employer or other family members that are impacted, and the economic costs associated with this in the form of lost productivity at work or of health concerns or of embezzlement or of Department of Human Services child welfare costs are significant, over $500 million in social costs annually. It's also important to remember, as has been mentioned, that disordered gambling is an addiction. It's not a moral failing. It's not a bad habit. It's not just being unlucky. And for the percentage of people who are impacted by it, it is devastating. Speaking specifically about House Bill 3317, we at the Oregon Health Authority do everything that we can to provide our services in a data-driven way. So we at this point know a great deal about the individual gambler. We know a lot about treatment. We know a lot about the person who comes in seeking treatment and what he or she describes as their game of choice and how much money they owe. But we don't know as much about the community that they're in. So having access to data which would potentially identify high-risk areas would be tremendously important. Prevention services in particular are community-driven. And community coalitions are a big part of them, so knowing the demographics and the needs of a community are tremendously important to us. So House Bill 3317A would provide useful information to OHA's problem gambling services for the purposes of strategic planning and programming. We would target those high-risk areas with problem gambling prevention and education messaging to reduce risk and harm and to improve referral pathways in those communities. I appreciate the opportunity to share this information with you. I would be happy to provide any additional information that you need. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? I'm kind of backed up with representatives, so thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 3317A, and I'm going to open a hearing on House Bill 3056A. Representative Kenny Geyer, please.
Mr. Vice Chair, committee members, House Bill 3656A allows state mortuary and cemetery board to refuse to issue a certificate of authority to operate crematorium or suspend or revoke certificate. If board determines crematorium endangers public health and safety, establishes that board must consider whether crematorium has met national industry standards for training and equipment. There are no amendments, there is no revenue impact, and there is no fiscal impact.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Alyssa Kenny-Geyer, House Representative for House District 46, parts of Northeast and Southeast Portland. And I brought this bill forward. It was a committee bill. I was the chair of Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency at the time. And I had a community, one of the neighborhoods in my district, Montevilla, had a funeral home that had been operating for decades in the community. It was a half a block away from Vestal Elementary School, which is now a K through 8, right behind their playground, and it was very beloved in the community. And then a national group came in and bought it as a, and turned it into a crematorium. And pretty soon there was billowing black smoke that was coming out. It was in the news frequently in Oregon, both in the print news and the, and in the TV news. And the neighbors would take pictures of it. It would also shake. There was someone right next door that had a, that used to teach piano lessons, and she could no longer offer the piano lessons. It was really a huge nuisance in the community, and they were concerned about the public health effects. The bill that I originally introduced as a committee bill was to limit the placement of crematorium near schools. I can't even remember now. I think it was like 500 feet or 1,000 feet, or that the board had the ability to not allow it near schools. And the mortuary, the Oregon Funeral Directors Association and the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board Association board members and the executive director came to me after that original bill came out, and they said, you know, there is concern around the country because there's mercury in amalgams and teeth and things like that, but really when these crematorium are operating properly, there's not a public safety concern. It as long as they're operating with national standards, the national equipment, national standards for equipment and training, and this company clearly was not doing that. So we had a really hard time reining in this company. DEQ's rule is when particulate matter is thick like that, it has to go for at least 6 minutes, and this would go out there for 3 or 4 or 5 minutes, but it wouldn't. No one caught it at over 6 minutes, so we couldn't use the DEQ national standards. And then there's also a noise standard that it was violating. Three different times, there was only one noise ordinance person in Portland for a city that size. It's been cut back because of, after the recession, both at the state level and the city level, noise ordinance people have been cut back. There was one person. He was able to come out three different times, several months apart. First it was a warning, then it was a fine, there was another fine, and it eventually was shut down. But this community and the school right next door with hundreds of kids had to endure this day after day, week after week, month after month. And so what the amended bill does in working with the State Mortuary and Cemetery Board was take away the language that had to do with schools or in the presence of children, not assume that crematorium were dangerous to public health when they're operated properly. So it took any of that kind of relationship away. And all it did was give permissive authority to the board to either not allow a license or to revoke a license if it looks like they're not meeting national standards. So this is just a permissive bill. I know that there was a letter of opposition I read from Randy, who may be here, Randy Chagan from Cascade Funeral Directors, raising certain points, and I want to just, you know, talk to them. Crematorium air emissions are already regulated by the DEQ. They're not entirely. They're under-regulated by the DEQ. It says that crematory operations have not previously been a significant concern in Oregon. No credible evidence that their emissions are a danger to the public. I would agree with him on that. I would say overall, it's an excellent industry, and we really need it. I plan to get cremated eventually, so I do think that the amendment deals
not
with that.
Not for a while, I hope.
It says, oh, yes, I agree. No more on bicycle accidents. It says, ask an unqualified agency to determine risk to the public. The Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board is a licensing and regulatory agency with no knowledge of science or crematory operations. I would argue with that. We have licensing boards that are made up of a majority of people related to the industry for the purpose exactly of holding their industries responsible. The State Mortuary and Cemetery Board consists of 11 members appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate. They include licensed funeral service practitioners, a licensed embalmer, representatives of private and publicly owned cemeteries, a representative from the crematorium, and members of the public. So I think this is a very good bill. It simply gives a tool to that board that is responsible for overseeing its industry. They don't have to use it, but in a case like this where there is a group operating out of compliance, could be other towns that don't even have a noise ordinance person, very hard to get the DEQ to come in at a minor level concern like this when they're concerned about diesel and wood-burning stoves and much bigger things on their plate. Simply a tool. I really appreciate having worked with members of the board, the Mortuary and Cemetery Board, as well as the Funeral Directors Association, to come to a bill that I think gives a tool much needed, rarely needed, but much needed. Happy to answer any questions.
Okay, any questions for the representative?
How are you doing?
I'm doing much better. No crutches this week. Excited. Thank you.
Good. It's always good to see you.
Thank you so much.
Okay, we have Randy Jaden. Go ahead, sir.
Okay. Vice Chair Gerard and members of the committee, my name is Randy Jaden. Thank you for giving me time to speak to you today. I own and operate Cascade Funeral Directors Incorporated. We're based in Tualatin, Oregon. We're a family-owned Oregon business. We operate funeral establishments throughout the Portland metropolitan area and the North Willamette Valley. We also own and operate Oregon's largest cremation facility, Cascade Cremation Center in Tualatin. I have reached out to each of you several times over the past few weeks, so you're probably kind of tired of hearing my letters and hearing from me, but the reality is I have some concerns about this bill. And I'd like to make it perfectly clear that I am not in any way, shape, or form opposed to crematory regulation. I would be, in fact, very, very supportive of proper crematory regulation and oversight. I believe that Representative Kenny Geyer's intentions were good, and I believe that she is sincerely trying to help her constituents in her district. I do not believe, however, that anyone has taken the time to think through the process and think what this could mean to the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board, and also to members of our industry, myself included. This bill is unnecessary. The bill is an emotional overreaction to an unfortunate but isolated incident in North Portland. The science behind crematory emissions directly contradicts the emotional testimony of House Bill 3056. Crematory operations have not previously been a problem in Oregon, and crematorium air emissions are regulated by DEQ. We have visits from DEQ periodically, and some counties even have more aggressive regulation in their own specific county. This House bill is arbitrary. I ask myself, exactly what is this bill attempting to regulate as it's currently written? If it's air emissions, well, DEQ already regulates that. If it's not air emissions, well, then what is it? Determining that a crematorium presents a danger to the public health and safety under this bill as an unqualified agency made up of volunteer citizens to determine risk to the public. An improper determination could have a devastating effect on a crematorium that is otherwise compliant and is necessary in our society. There is no credible evidence that crematory emissions are a danger to the public health or safety. This bill places authority in an improper agency. The Oregon Cemetery and Mortuary and Cemetery Board is a licensing and regulatory agency. They have no knowledge of or experience in the science of crematory operations. With that said, I sincerely encourage the committee to not move this bill forward. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you for your testimony. Going to close. Anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 3056? I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 3056 and open a hearing on House Bill 3455. Representative Widener. Apologize, I saw you were here to testify, but I looked and I didn't see you over on the side.
Mr. Vice Chair and committee members, House Bill 3455 increases membership of the All-Terrain Vehicle Advisory Committee from 14 to 16 members, adding one representative of a rural fire protection district and one representative of emergency medical services providers, directs Park and Recreation Department to establish and operate outreach program to inform law enforcement agencies, rural fire protection districts, and emergency medical service providers about the grant process for monies from the All-Terrain Vehicle account. There are no amendments, there is no revenue impact, and there's a minimal fiscal impact.
Go ahead, Representative.
Mr. Vice Chair. And Mr. Chair is not here today. So members of the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation, thank you for hearing 3455 today. My name is State Rep. Jim Widener from House District 24, encompassing most of Yamhill County and parts of Southwest Washington County. House Bill 3455 passed the House floor unanimously. And this is a very simple and common sense piece of legislation. Oregon offers a wide range of diverse outdoor activities. My family and I have always been enthusiastic about recreational ATVs for both the pleasure of trail riding and for hunting. Like most extreme sports, riding ATVs comes with a real element of danger and responsibility and the possibility of serious bodily injury, even death sometimes. I have worked with all concerned parties related to ATVs. We have had lengthy discussions with fire district chiefs all across Oregon, uploaded on OLIS, you can easily find 10 letters of support for this bill. Seven of those are from rural fire district chiefs who couldn't make it here today, and one is from the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, and others from EMS providers and those who operate ATV recreational facilities. From these discussions and working alongside the ATV divisions of Parks and Recreation Department, rural fire chiefs, and ATV activists and enthusiasts, we have crafted common sense solution that has a wide range of support. This is a very simple concept. This bill will add an EMS and fire district representative onto the ATV Advisory Committee as voting members. The current committee has 15 members that includes ATV dealers, ATV enthusiasts, U.S. Forest Service, law enforcement, Bureau of Land Management, Department of Human Services, State Department of Forestry, Department of Transportation, Department of Fish and Wildlife, Americans with Disabilities Act representative, and members from Parks and Recreation Department. This list seems to include almost every feasible association or department associated with ATVs, except for the people you call on when someone's life is in danger of an accident or if there's a fire district. When we talked to involved parties, everyone agreed that fire district and EMS should have been appointed long ago. When we talked to fire chiefs and EMS providers, we were extremely excited about this idea, and they felt they were long overdue for representation on this committee. Due to the extreme nature of ATV recreation and the remote locations in which recreation takes place, fire districts and EMS need to be on the committee to address the increasing size, weight, and carrying capacity of these ATVs being produced and used today. Furthermore, they need to be kept up to date on trail development and upcoming grants. It is essential for the safety of Oregon citizens that fire district and EMS providers know about upcoming grants available so they can receive adequate funds to offer sufficient resources when accidents occur. They need to be able to quickly and adequately traverse the difficult terrain to address the severity of situations. Quick response with the properly trained equipment, firefighters and EMT make all the difference on outcomes of any accident that happens. In these cases, a quick response can save injured citizens from dismemberment, disability, and even death. Unfortunately, we have been told by fire districts and EMS that they feel inadequate in response times and resource for accidents of and fires started in wild terrain where ATV sports enthusiasts recreate. Having fire and EMS on the ATV advisory committee will keep them informed. They will provide invaluable input on the expertise on ATV issues. Having active representation on this committee will help them acquire and give information about available funds necessary for protecting Oregon ATV enthusiasts in our forest. The Parks and Recreation Department have worked with us, and they found creative solutions to these fire districts and EMS who lack resources. Their solution was to draft language included in the bill to establish outreach programs to inform law enforcement, fire district, and EMS to available grant opportunities and become a resource to provide clarification to answer questions about the grant application process. Again, I want to thank you for hearing this bill today, Vice Chair Gerard. So I got Chair Beyer written down here, but
you had to ad lib, huh?
I'll ad lib that part. But thank you for your support on this common sense solution for Oregonians and the safety of our environment. And I urge you to work this bill and move it out of the committee today.
Any questions for the representatives? Go ahead, Senator Monroe.
You know, this bill makes a lot of sense to me. I've been a traffic and outdoor safety person all my life, and I like the outdoors as you do. But it seems to me that's an awful big committee. How many total are on that committee?
So there's 14 that are voting members, but there's 15. So we're adding fire and EMS. There's a grant committee that's a smaller committee that actually allocates the funds. So when they apply for them, okay. So fire and EMS will not be on that committee. But the whole goal with these funds coming in is actually to create trails. One of the things you run into, though, is we're getting in the backwoods country, some of these places where you can't get with an EMS vehicle, so they need to have the proper ATVs to get down in there and pull people out. And actually, Oregon is fortunate that we have a couple companies that manufactures ATVs designed for the backwoods country for handling these situations.
Well, I hope it works out. It just seems to me that my experience, 40 years in government, is that the bigger the committee, the harder it is to reach any consensus.
Yeah. Well, and that's the reason we want to keep the grant committee small. This is just to add input to think about safety issues and fire issues that can occur in these areas.
Okay, makes sense.
Okay. Any other questions for the representative? Okay, free to go. Anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 3455A? Seeing none, I'm going to close the hearing on 3455A, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3455A. The Vice Chair moves House Bill 3455A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any opposition? So moved, and I'll carry. Okay, is this going to open a work session on House Bill 3031A. James, you want to tell us what's going on there?
Vice Chair, committee members, House Bill 3031, we have heard before in the early part of May. Since then, it has received a -12 amendment. And so the -12 amendment replaces the original measure. It defines debt buyer as a person that engages in the business of purchasing delinquent or charged off debt for the purpose of collecting debt, requires that the caller uses automatic dialing and announcing device must provide within the first 10 seconds, the method for a subscriber being called to notify caller via a single signal or code that subscriber does not wish to receive future calls, requires caller using automatic dialing and announcing device to exclude from call list subscribers who had notified caller of wish not to receive future calls, creates exemptions for collections agency, debt buyer, or debt collector, public safety or law enforcement representative, and a caller that has an established business relationship with the subscriber. Allows prosecuting attorney to require a person believed to have information about unlawful robocalls to testify and provide evidence as part of the investigation. Applies to calls made or made on or after January 1st, 2016. Declares emergency effective on passage. There is no revenue impact with the amendment, and there is a minimal fiscal impact with the A-12 amendment.
Okay, you have any questions about the A-12's amendments? Chair moves the -12 amendments. Is there any opposition? Seeing none, so moved. Chair moves House Bill 3031A as amended with the -12 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any opposition? Seeing none, so moved. Do we have a volunteer who wants to carry that?
I'll carry.
Senator Thompson wishes to carry. Okay. I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 3031A. I'm going to go to the top of the list now. Okay. We're going to start where we should have started. Okay, I'm going to open a hearing on House Bill 3274A.
Mr. Vice Chair, Committee Members, House Bill 3274A directs Oregon Business Development Department to conduct study on methods to expand broadband and telecommunications infrastructure in rural cities and counties. Requires study report to be submitted to interim legislative committees by December 31st, 2016. Declares emergency effective on passage. There is no amendment. There is no revenue impact, and there's a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay, I opened a hearing. Is there anyone wants to testify on House Bill 3274A? I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 3274A and open a work session on House Bill 3274A. The Vice Chair moves House Bill 3274A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Okay. Is there any opposition? Seeing none, so moved. Senator Riley will carry. I will close the hearing on House Bill 3274A. 3488. Going to open a hearing on House Bill 3488. Sean Jillians.
Mr. Vice Chair, committee members, House Bill 3488 requires proceeds of fee, commission, or other payment to declarant or other person upon transfer of interest in real property to be used exclusively to benefit property or support activities directly benefiting property residents in order for affordable housing covenant, servitude, easement, condition, or restriction to be exempt from prohibition of such fee, commission, or other payment. There are no amendments. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Go ahead, Sean.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians representing the Oregon Association of Realtors in support of House Bill 3488. Several years ago, in 2009, you all made the decision unanimously to prohibit what were called private transfer fees. Effectively, what it was is there was this company who came up with a clever way to share in the increase in home sale prices over the perpetuity of the property. And what they do is attach a covenant to the property, and it wouldn't kick on the first sale, but every subsequent sale after that, there would be a 1% fee or something similar that would revert back to the original owner, and out of the goodness of administering the fee, this company would take half of those proceeds. It was a very clever scheme which lasted for a few years. You all made the wise decision to prohibit them in 2009. Since that time, the Federal Financing and Housing Agency came out with rules. They became wise to this scheme as well and said that Freddie and Fannie would not securitize or purchase any mortgages that were subject to these fees unless very narrow exceptions were made, and that was that it had to directly benefit the subject property. In 2009, we left an exclusion for affordable housing, which we all wanted to do to make sure we didn't inadvertently impact land trusts. Our exclusion was a little broad. We're aware of one entity that is sort of abusing that exclusion, and so what we're doing is bringing Oregon law in line with the federal rules, tightening up our affordable housing, basically just saying if there's affordable housing covenant, it has to actually directly benefit the property or the people who live in the property in the fee. With that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions. It was unanimous in the House as well. We've talked to the affordable housing folks on the House side. They were comfortable with the language as well because they legitimately do these sort of fees.
Okay, any questions? Guess you're good to go.
All right, thank you, Mr. Vice Chair.
Can I close the hearing on House Bill 3488? And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3488. The Vice Chair moves House Bill 3488 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any opposition? No moved. I'll carry. Okay, I'm going to open a hearing on House Bill 3011A. Go ahead, James.
Mr. Vice Chair, committee members, House Bill 3011A allows dispensaries for Class 1 flammable liquids located in counties with populations less than 40,000 residents to permit self-dispensing of such liquids when no owner, operator, or employee of a dispensary is present. Specifies that dispensaries may continue to operate at self-service dispensaries if population of county increases above 40,000 residents. We do have an amendment, the dash 2. It modifies when self-dispensing fuels can occur from when no owner, operator, or employee of the dispensary is present to after 6 p.m. and before 6 a.m. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact with that dash 2 amendment. And on the original measure, there's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact as well.
Is there anybody wish to testify on House Bill 3011A?
I signed up.
Oh, sorry. Mr. Romaine. And actually, Scott Bartlett. Bartlett.
Yeah.
You can come up too if you wish.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm with the Romaine Group, and we're here representing the Oregon Fuels Association. We're in full support of the bill. I was going to make a comment about I must have seen some pigs flying somewhere outside because I thought that would be when I would see this occur, but I won't make that comment.
I think I know what you're referring to.
Yes. This is just a very simple realization that there are parts of the state where you really can't get fuel, or it's so expensive that it's cost prohibitive. We're closing gas stations. And this simply says that in certain areas of the state, rural parts of the state, that you can have an unattended station. It's very practical. It's almost comical to watch some folks pull up to gas stations up in Washington State, especially with sort of a hobby up there. They watch and see the people with the Oregon license plates pull up and wait and wait and wait. You can get self-service in Oregon right now at Indian reservations out in Umatilla County. I know because I pulled up to the station there and waited and waited and waited, and nobody came out, and then I realized where I was. But this, again, just applies to areas where it's really necessary because there aren't people around, and you can't really afford to have people there, and it's either close the station or price it so expensive that it's ridiculous. So with that, we would hope you would support the bill. Anything is at least a good start to show people that it works. Thank you.
Okay. I'm just going to hear the panel here, then we can direct questions. Okay, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Vice Chair Girard and members of the committee. My name is Scott Bartlett, and I'm coming here as a private citizen, someone who in the 1989 and 91 sessions as a legislative assistant worked for hundreds of hours with then Representative Dwyer and with the Republican leadership of the House and the Democratic leadership of the Senate in crafting what is now the existing bill, which encompasses a lot of what New Jersey statute has. And it really beefed up Oregon's statute. And it was in response to paralyzed veterans, AAA of Oregon, many other factions to strengthen Oregon's historic self-service statute. I am not in favor of this bill, but if this bill is going to pass, I would like to draw a few things to your attention. If you read this bill, its general presumption, as Paul as basically said, is that it will help folks way out in stranded areas who just can't get any gas, that you know these things are closing or whatever. Does that include Hood River? Does that include the Dalles? Does that include Astoria? Does that include Ontario? Those cities? No, it doesn't. But it might include other remote areas. But the way it's been presented is that folks from Portland or Eugene or whatever have been way out in Rome or Jordan Valley or wherever, and they just miscalculated, and it's 3 in the morning, and they can't get any gas, and gosh, oh, shucks, you know, let's have self-service. Okay, maybe that might be appropriate. But in this bill, it doesn't say that this would only be in non-working hours. Let me read it to you. The owner or operator may, during hours that no owner, operator, or employee is present at the dispensary, permit a person to dispense gas. Well, that means the owner doesn't have to be there. The owner could be gone for 3 weeks. They don't have to be open. In essence, it's de facto self-service. The House research on this, the measure summary, says that it should be confined or to southeastern Oregon. But this law goes from Astoria to the Dalles to Curry County to Lakeview, all across Oregon. So when I hear that there's no revenue consequences, I'd like to mention something to you. I called up the state fire marshal's office yesterday. I talked to the manager of licensing and permitting. They had created a staff analysis of what revenue consequences could be, what their tasks might be to inspect these facilities. They recommended that liability insurance, or she mentioned that liability insurance might be warranted, that they'd have to investigate all the safety equipment. That would require fire marshal personnel to inspect these facilities. So you could be talking about thousands of Oregon motorists across Oregon accessing these facilities at all hours of the day. In essence, it's a de facto self-service, you know, semi-bill. And all I ask is that you consider the implications of this and tighten the language to narrow the scope of permissibility for this. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Barnhart, you want to take the podium here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the chance to testify on this bill today. My name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the state representative from House District 11. The bill passed the House, as you know, with not much controversy. I think that's an understatement. And I have reviewed the language of the bill with the reference that Mr. Bartlett raised with me earlier today. He's very well known to me as a constituent of mine. The story he just told us about his history with self-service gas in Oregon was not known to me until just now, but I appreciate hearing it. As I looked at the bill today, earlier, trying to understand the issues that he raised, it does seem to have a pretty significant hole in it, and exactly the one that he suggested, which I had not been aware of. When we voted on the bill, this was not in any of the committees that I'm a member in. I have a different position than he does. I have no problem at all with the idea that in remote locations, during non-business hours, that people ought to be allowed to pump their own gas. I do not think this, however, should be a vehicle through which self-service gas generally can be driven. And I think he's probably correct in the way the bill is, the language of the bill as it's actually drafted, at least leaves that ambiguous. And I would suggest that the committee may want to consider an amendment that restricts this to non-business hours or something of the like that would make it clear that you're expecting these service stations would still be staffed most of the time, and that this would be the exception, not the rule.
Go ahead, Senator. Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you seen the Dash 2 amendment?
I'm sorry, I have not.
Okay, so we do have a Dash 2 amendment that restricts it to after 6 p.m. and before 6 a.m.
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, that sounds like the sort of change that I was contemplating after I'd received the concern from Mr. Bartlett that I received earlier today.
So, and Mr. Chair, I would support this bill with that amendment.
Okay. Any other comments for this committee?
Yeah, Romaine wants to say something.
Well, I think they all agreed to it once.
Could I add a short story
that I should have given earlier?
In 2001, in his great wisdom, the Secretary of State appointed me to be the state representative from House District 55. which is Senator Representative McLean's district now, which stretches all the way into Lakeview. I received an invitation to go to visit the school there in Paisley, which I did. And on the way home, I realized that I should have bought gas at the service station in Paisley because it was getting late, and I didn't think I had fuel to get me over the top of the mountain. Well, it turned out that I was able to pull into a gas station where the intersection is. Is it Chemult? I believe it is Chemult. About 5 minutes to 10 in the evening, that service station closed at 10 o'clock. I was able to purchase gasoline and drive home. This bill, with the Dash 2 amendments that Senator Riley referred to, would have allowed me not to have had the anxiety of the possibility of spending the night someplace between Chemult and Oak Ridge.
Okay. Mr. Romaine?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, first of all, we're supportive of the amendments that restrict the hours because we're basically just trying to show that it works and you can do it. But we really can't get fuel out in those areas at an economical cost to the consumer. That's the real reason for this thing. When you're drafting something that applies statewide, it's really hard to pick the communities and basically go through and say this applies in this town but not that town, in this town not that town. And I think what the author of the bill did was just try to pick a general number that applied to most of Eastern Oregon. And this applies to all of Eastern Oregon except for Yamhill, Deschutes, and Klamath counties. It also, because of that number, applies to Clatsop County, Tillamook County, and Curry County. So those are the only counties sort of west of the Cascades. Yes, there are probably some stations out there that you could make an argument they have plenty of people and traffic and everything, and then there are other stations that don't. But this is, it's a good first attempt to kind of make this work. And frankly, you'll be able to see, are there problems with the self-serve? Is this something that really shouldn't go anyplace? Is this something that we maybe should look at? We don't know. But it's time that we actually kind of move into the modern world. The early 50s are when the self-serve ban first came into place, and it was put in place by people we now represent, the gasoline dealers. And the reason they didn't want it is they wanted to keep the major oil companies out. And that was a way to try and keep the major oil companies out. And if you look at the statute, it has all these things about safety. Well, my wife was the last one to blow up a gas station, literally. And it wasn't her fault. She handed a credit card to the person who was filling the tank back in the early 80s. And the guy went in, ran the card, did the whole thing, came back out, gave her, she signed. She started the car and drove off, and he had forgotten to take the pump out, and it was before the breakaways. So they literally had to foam the station down and close it. It was an interesting experience. But it is something that can be done. We will make it work. And I think with the amendment where it just applies after 6 at night and before 6 in the morning, you do get a pretty good restriction in there. And I think this is something where it's time, at least in the underserved areas of the state, to give it a chance. Thanks.
Go ahead, sir.
I appreciate those comments, and I appreciate the creation of this Dash Amendment. I would just say to this, you know, we Oregonians, maybe you're part of us, and in this regard, have been proud that we have certain things that we don't have, one of which has been self-service. One of the aspects of the formation of this bill is that when you have attendants on the premises, they can look at the tires and say, hey, your tires are bald or whatever. Not being perfect and making mistakes a lot. This happened to me when I was taking a child up to OHSU a couple weeks ago. My tires were bald. There are statistical reasons why having an attendant on the site is a valuable thing. It can save lives. So all I would ask you is to consider whatever unintended consequences may ensue. This is not just southeastern Oregon. It's all over Oregon. It's self-service light. And with that said, the amendment would be very warranted and appreciated. Thank you.
Any further questions for this panel? Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on House Bill 3011A?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Seeing none, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 3011A, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3011A, and the chair will move the Dash 2 amendments. Is there any opposition to the Dash 2? So moved. The vice chair will move to the floor House Bill 3011A as amended with the Dash 2 amendments to the floor with a due pass. Is there any opposition? Seeing none, so moved. Senator Thompson, you wish to carry that one?
Sure.
I mean, that's a pretty good bill, I think. All right. I'm going to open a hearing on House Bill 2958. Go ahead, James.
Mr. Vice Chair, Committee Members, House Bill 2958 provides that limited license obtained by a rental company to sell insurance in connection with renting vehicles also extends to rental companies' employees and designated agents, becomes operative 91 days after effective date of act, declares emergency effective on passage. There is no revenue impact. There is no fiscal impact. We do have a Dash 1 amendment, modifies conditions of limited license to apply to an employee of rental company to offer and sell insurance in accordance with ORS 744.854 for vehicles that rental company rents. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact with that Dash 1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good. Thank you for coming up. Having so much trouble reading how to pronounce it. Go for it.
Vice Chair Girard, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Car and Truck Rental and Leasing Association of Oregon. First of all, I want to thank Representative Hovey for bringing forth this bill and his committee administrator for working with us on it. And also for I'd like to thank Senator Riley and his office for bringing forth the Dash 1 amendments. We appreciate that, and we certainly support them. This is a very simple bill, and what it basically does is plays catch-up with today's situation where we have many customer demands for acquiring a rental vehicle beyond normal business hours. So we have partnered with business shops, small airports, as our designated agents to provide our rental vehicles to their customers when we are not able to. The current language of 744.856 does not make clear that these designated agents would be included in the car rental company's limited license. And so to make sure we are meeting the intent of the law, we have introduced House Bill 2958 to make it clear that designated agents would be included in the car rental company's limited licensure. As I've said before, we support the Dash 1 amendments. Thank you for hearing this bill today. With me today is Ron Spires from Enterprise Rent-A-Car, and he would be glad to answer any questions if the committee has them. Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead. Or do you have? Is there any questions for the committee?
We're good.
You're good?
Yes.
Is there anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 2958? Going to close the hearing on House Bill 2958, and I'm going to open a work session for House Bill 2958. The vice chair moves the Dash 1 amendments. Is there any opposition? Seeing none, so moved. The vice chair moves House Bill 2958 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any opposition? Seeing none, so moved. I need a carrier. Can I carry that one?
Sure.
Senator Monroe will carry. I'm going to go back. I'm going to change something here. I'm going to go back to House Bill 3011A, and I'm going to just put on for the record that instead of Senator Thompson, Senator Farioli will carry. I'll close that, and we're going to move to which is the next one we got? You like how I do things?
Yeah, it's good. It's good. Just keep this guy awake. 2987.
I'm going to open a hearing on 2987.
Mr. Vice Chair, committee members, House Bill 2987 removes requirement for contracting agency to reserve monies for including green energy technology in constructing, reconstructing, or renovating public building. If contracting agency determines including green technology is not appropriate for a particular construction or renovation project, requires contracting agency to report to Department of Energy amount that would have been spent on green energy technology had contracting agency determined that the including green energy technology is appropriate and use that money for green energy technology in a future construction or renovation project. Requires Department of Energy to report annually to Legislative Assembly on contract and agency compliance with reporting mandates. Declares emergency effective on passage, becomes operative January 1st, 2016. There are no amendments, there is no revenue impact, and has a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay, we have two signed up. I think it's Beth Vargas Duncan and Tracy Rutten.
Vice Chair Girard, members of the committee, I'm Beth Vargas-Duncan, the Executive Director of Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association. We are a statewide association with 11 cities that have a municipal utility attached or connected to the city. And municipally owned utilities are governed by their city council or utility board, comprised of community members who set their rates, regulatory policies, develop programs and services, and respond to specific customer needs with the primary focus of enabling delivery of affordable, reliable, and safe electricity. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on House Bill 2987. I participated, along with some of my colleagues, in the Department of Energy's rulemaking regarding this bill, and it was during that time that we discovered, I believe what was not necessarily intended, when there are times that we're doing a public remodel or reconstruction of a public building, and there are funds, it might not be appropriate to use those green technology funds on that project, that originally the state statute would require us to keep those in a separate account indefinitely. We noted that that was not necessarily a prudent use of public funds, and so that's how we ended up with this piece of legislation that Representative Holvey has kindly brought forward today.
Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tracy Rutten with the League of Oregon Cities. I will echo what Beth already indicated. We are supportive of the bill. We thank Representative Holvey for introducing this bill to essentially create a fix for the issue that Beth already discussed, which is the carryover of funds. That carryover occurs when there are state funds used on a project and when it was deemed to be not appropriate, as Beth indicated, for the investment in green energy technology, that either being due to shading around a public building or just a lack of solar that would be generated based on various criteria around that public building. In terms of bonded dollars for public agencies, to carry those over and then hold them in a separate bank account is just not consistent with government accounting practices. So we appreciate your support of this bill. Thank you.
Any questions for this panel? Boy, you're getting off easy today. Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 2987? Seeing none, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2987. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2987. The Vice Chair moves House Bill 2987 to the floor with a due pass. Recommendation, is there any objection? Seeing none, so moved. Any volunteers? Senator Riley will carry. Okay, I'm going to open a hearing on 3242.
Mr. Vice Chair, committee members, House Bill 3242 allows mortuary and cemetery board to grant temporary operating permit for purpose of performing interment in cemetery that does not have a valid license. Restricts granting temporary permit to situations in which there is an existing prearrangement sales contract. Directs board to adopt rules regarding temporary operating permits. Sunsets authority to grant temporary operating permit on January 1st, 2018. Declares emergency effective on passage. There are no amendments. There is no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Wally Odoman?
Not bad.
I apologize. With a name like Gerard, I'm used to having it mispronounced, so excuse me if I bombed it.
No worries. Thank you, Vice Chair Gerard and members of the committee. Good afternoon. For the record, Wally Ordeman. I'm a funeral director in Albany and represent the Oregon Funeral Directors Association. House Bill 3242 was introduced by the funeral directors to try and get in front of an issue that has been or could be problematic for every community in the state. Cemeteries, large and small, urban, rural, can lose their credentials to operate because of abandonment, bankruptcy, or disciplinary action. Currently, the Mortuary and Cemetery Board has no authority to appoint someone to take care of at-need burials. That is to say, those people who currently own cemetery property cannot hold memorialization services in unlicensed cemeteries when those cemeteries have lost their status as a cemetery. The basic premise of the bill is to allow the mortuary board to the authority to issue what we're calling day passes to qualified industry people so that burials can take place in a timely manner when a cemetery has lost their license for whichever reason. This would be on a case-by-case basis. They would be temporary passes just to allow for those at-need burials. The bill we've introduced is considered by the industry to be emergent, and we will encourage that a work group of all stakeholders be formed to provide a more permanent fix to this very real problem. With an aging population of Oregon's volunteer fraternal organizations, cemetery caretakers, as well as other financial struggles of Oregon's cemeteries, the threat of cemetery abandonment becomes more real every day. The OFDA strongly encourages the passage of 3242, has heard of no opposition, and would like to participate in the efforts of any future work group that is formed for permanent resolutions to this issue. We appreciate you considering this and hope that you will work the bill and move it forward for us.
Colleagues, you have any questions for House Bill 3242A for this individual? Boy, it's getting down to the nitty-gritty. Okay, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 3242A and open a work session on House Bill 3242A. The Vice Chair moves House Bill 3242A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any opposition? Seeing none, so moved. Senator Monroe will carry.
Very appropriate, Mr. Vice Chair, since most people think I already have one foot in the grave.
Yeah, not too far behind. Okay, going to open a work set, or not, excuse me, I'm going to open a hearing on House Bill 3244A. James?
Mr. Vice Chair, Committee Members, House Bill 3244A provides that borrower or borrower's agent may rely on lender's payoff statement for purpose of establishing amount borrower must pay to satisfy obligation under real estate loan agreement unless borrower delivers an amended payoff statement. Provides that lender may recover amount borrower owes that did not appear on payoff statement or amended payoff statement only as unsecured debt or by foreclosing other properties securing the obligation. Declares emergency effective on passage. There are no amendments. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Okay. Please go ahead and come forward. I don't see is Representative Esquivel here.
We called and
he's not going to make it. Okay. Tess, you signed up first. I don't care who goes first, but if you want to, that's fine.
Great. Thank you, Vice Chair Gerard, members of the committee. My name is Tess Milio with CFM Strategic Communications, representing the Oregon Land Title Association. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today in support of House Bill 3244A. And we want to thank Rep. Esquivel for helping us with this bill, even though he couldn't be here. So we worked with him and the Oregon Bankers Association and the Northwest Credit Union Association to come up with the language that's before you today. So in many cases, when someone is selling their house, they still have part of their loan outstanding. During closing, an escrow agency will submit payment based on the amount listed on the lender-prepared payoff statement from the seller, who is also the borrower, to the lender in order to fulfill the borrower's loan obligation. In certain real estate transactions, after closing has occurred, the lender will come forward asserting that the borrower owes more money than was originally listed on the payoff statement. House Bill 3244A prevents the lender from placing a lien on the sold property after closing and after the obligation of the payoff statement has been met. It continues to allow lenders and borrowers to address their contractual agreement independently of the parties involved in the new real estate purchase. So the language in House Bill 3244 was amended in the House to satisfy the concerns of the Oregon Bankers Association and the Northwest Credit Union Association. And we'd like to thank those stakeholders for working with us on this bill. There is no known opposition to the bill as written, and it did pass through the House unanimously. So thank you for your consideration of House Bill 3244A. I'm available for any questions, and at this point I'd like to turn it over to Alan Brickley, who is a title professional and could provide background on the need for this legislation.
Okay, Alan, go ahead, please.
Yes, Vice Chairman Girard, members of the committee, my name is Alan Brickley. I am counsel for First American Title Insurance Company with offices in Portland, Oregon, and around the state, but I am here actually speaking on behalf of the Oregon Land Title Association. I'd like to also express my appreciation to the various stakeholders and Representative Esquivel who have assisted in this. Just very briefly, the problem was outlined well by Tesmilio, but just I can tell you as a practical matter, we've had any number of situations where the lien that was placed on the property is continued by the lender, and based on their refusal to accept the payoffs amounts that were identified in their letter, which created hardship not only for escrow agents but for subsequent borrowers who may be named in actions. Probably the one most egregious example I can think of was a situation where a national lender, 4 months after the closing, rejected a wire of all of the funds and immediately commenced foreclosure proceedings, much to the consternation of the new buyer. That matter, I think, is either still pending or may have just settled, but it is just an example, the worst example, of that situation. So I would urge support of House Bill 3244A. And I'm available to answer any questions.
Any questions for go ahead, Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I want to understand this a little better. What I think I'm hearing is that currently the banks or credit unions, the holder of the loan, after settlement is all done, title's transferred, everything has happened, then you get an amended payoff statement. And they are looking to the title company for payment. And this bill would change that so that they now look to the new owner for payment instead of the title company and leaving you out of that loop.
No.
Vice Chair Girard and Senator Riley, that's not quite correct.
Could you explain it to me?
Yes. The borrower is responsible under the terms of their note and under the terms of their loan agreement continuously. What this doesn't this proposed bill does not shift the burden for payment. It's still the same. The only thing that it does is to say to the lender, once you've submitted a payoff statement to an escrow agent and that payoff statement is met to the penny, then they no longer have the continuing right, which they had previously, to assert a lien on the property, which is now in the hands of a bona fide purchaser.
Okay.
So it doesn't shift the burden. It just...
Follow up, please.
Yeah, go ahead.
So in that case, there's still an obligation to pay. Who has that obligation at this point?
Assuming that there is a continuing obligation to pay some amounts pursuant to the original contract, it would be the original borrower or the current borrower who had the loan agreement.
Okay. So this just keeps them from putting a lien on the new owner.
That's
on the property.
That's correct. It keeps them from continuing to assert a lien on the property that is now in the hands of a bona fide purchaser, which they have used in the past as a lever to extract additional funds.
Got it. Thank you.
Any further questions? I think you took care of that question very well. Yes, I agree. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 3186? Seeing none, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 3186, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3186. The Vice Chair moves House Bill 3186 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so moved. All carried.
Yeah,
3244. Sorry, 3244. Should I start over?
Was that 3244?
No, you're good.
Let's do it again.
You want to do it again?
Yeah, let's do it again.
I think I better go back. I'm going to open a work session on 3244A. The Vice Chair will move House Bill 3244A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objections?
This time I object. No.
He doesn't. Seeing none, so moved. All carry. Oh, man, you got me flustered now. Okay, the last one that I see, I'm going to open a hearing on House Bill 3186. Elaine and Glenn.
Mr. Vice Chair, House Bill 3186 deletes language prohibiting the promotion of or advertisement of outdoor mass gathering without a permit, clarifies circumstances where permanent development may occur on land where mass outdoor gathering takes place, declares emergency, effective on passage. There are no amendments. There is no revenue impact statement and no fiscal impact.
Okay, please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for your time here today. For the record, my name is Elaine Albridge. I'm an attorney at Stoll Reeves, and I'm here to support House Bill 3186. The purpose of this bill is a simple, narrow fix to address an outdated statutory regulatory framework governing outdoor mass gatherings. There are two proposed revisions to the statutory framework. The first one is to account for advances in technology and social media and allow for promotion of an event prior to obtaining an outdoor mass gathering permit from the local jurisdiction. And the second revision is to clarify with plain language that any permanent development on the site is still subject to local land use regulations through the local governing jurisdiction. The benefits of the bill are that it's narrow, and it's simple, and it does not undermine a local jurisdiction's ability to review and approve an outdoor mass gathering. And I also would direct your attention to the written testimony in the record of the bill, particularly a letter from former Wasco County Planning Director Mr. John Roberts, helps explain the benefits and the practical ramifications from a local jurisdiction's perspective. And with that, I would close unless there are any questions and encourage the committee to move the bill forward today. Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is Glenn Boyd. I'm a producer of a small arts and music festival in rural Wasco County. Thank you for hearing our testimony today. I'm in support of House Bill 3186 in order to clarify the permit process. And once again, like Elaine said, is to bring forward the into the 21st century. I particularly have faced both of these challenges as year to year as I produce my festival. Each year we go through a very rigorous process to obtain our permit for a mass gathering. It's a multi-month process. We have heard multiple times of just the fact that we have a website or the fact that we have a Facebook page. We are in violation of this condition that we are promoting our event before it even has been granted. These laws made sense in the 70s when what you had is some producers who would go out, run a big ad in the paper, have a big gathering, concert, event, church gathering, whatever it may be, and they had no way of turn off the faucet. People would show up and they would throw their hands up and say, well, I couldn't tell them not to come in some way. So the law came into effect for a very good reason, which was to tell people, don't do that. Don't go run big ads in the paper and have, you know, 5,000 people show up and use this as an end run around the having people gather. Things have changed since then. We now have the ability to, with a simple email or a simple, you know, publishing to let
tens of thousands of people know that, hey, this event will not be occurring because we did not meet our, you know, obligations and did not obtain our permit. We have that ability not to sell tickets. We have ability to reverse all these kind of processes. But what we don't have today is we have this constant issue of when are we in violation of this if so much as a website says, oh, we'll look forward to seeing you next year at our event. Is that promoting an event that may or may not occur depending on the permit that happens the following year? The other portion of the amendment is the same thing. The language is ambiguous when referring to physical alterations. The fact of just moving a post to widen the gate to allow emergency vehicle to come through is considered a physical alteration, even though it's permitted under county development, under the current county rules. So the key here is not to allow us to go build a sports arena or an amphitheater that's not permitted. And I get that, but we shouldn't have this hang up on one particular word that if I move a gate or a fence post that I've physically altered the property and therefore once again in violation of the mass gathering.
Any questions? Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the original reason for not allowing advertising before you had a permit was, as you stated, to make sure that people didn't show up and, you know, they're there, where's the event? And I see how you could do some mitigation, but I don't see how you can catch everybody who might know. I understand the part about the website, see you next year, but once you say there's going to be an event held on June 22nd, 2015, at this place, and you don't yet have a permit, I think that becomes problematic.
Well, the changes do not allow the event to occur. You would still be in violation of the law if you held the event, and all the remedies, including injunctions, still exist with the county and the district attorney to enforce that. All of those things still exist. None of that goes away. It's it just clarifies where today we are almost always in violation in some people's minds just by the sheer fact that Facebook exists in the world. It may not even be me that promotes a particular event. It could be some people who have attended and they themselves say, oh, this has been exciting, come back next year, and they post things about it. This is construed as promoting and advertising if you look at the current language.
And there's an insert letter of the distinction between ticket sales and promotion.
Follow up, please. Yeah. Oh. Senator Riley.
So, yeah, I get that it's still, if you have to have the permit for the event. I don't quite still see how this stops people from showing up. Mm-hmm. Once you've advertised and then don't get the permit.
Mr. Vice Chair and Senator Riley, I think I can answer that question. There's a distinction between advertising and promotion versus ticket sales and the availability of tickets. Do you want to address that?
Well, I mean, this applies to all, you know, events, not just ours in particular. This could be a church gathering, just having a website that says, you know, about what is taking place. Any mass gathering where there's people there, anytime you have social media, you're in violation of this rule. It doesn't stop people from showing up. Today's technology gives you a much better platform for communicating to people that the event is not sanctioned or is not permitted or is not allowed. That's what I made as far as in today's technology, you can do that where you could not do that in the past. I think if there is somebody out there who is going to promote an event and push it through, they would have done this with the current languages as it is. They would just continue to have an event without a permit. This doesn't change that rule. Like I said, it doesn't take away the power of the local authorities to stop an event.
My question isn't about permits.
Sure.
It has nothing to do with whether you have a permit to hold the event. It has to do with how you notify people that you have said there's going to be an event, and then it doesn't occur. Mm-hmm. That's my problem, not the fact that I understand that you can't hold the event if you don't get the permit, but there still could be some people show up. And that's what the original intent, I'm sure, of the not advertising the event before you had the permit. So I still have this question. And it has nothing to do with ticket sales, because not all events that are advertised have ticket sales. It's about advertising an event in whatever manner, in a paper, on a website, with an airplane trailer. I don't care how you do it. How do you unadvertise? That's the key, and make and have people not show up.
In the same, and I agree that that is a challenge, and in the same effort, you have the opposite problem where we do absolutely no promotion ourselves. We do no advertising ourselves, but there is a perception because of the fact that in this day and age we maintain a website or that there is a Facebook presence that talks about the future and the past, that is used as an excuse to say, oh, there's being promoting or there's being advertising done for something when there has not been.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Riley, maybe to help address your specific concern, I think there always will be a risk that some folks could show up, mm-hmm. but I think the thought process behind the bill is that technology and social media and access to online information has advanced to such a degree that communicating a message out to the public or potential attendees is adequate to provide the necessary lead time in order to prevent people to show up.
I understand that.
Yeah.
And I don't agree with it, but I understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And may I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
So have you had someone... Have you been fined or anything for violation of this?
So there's been situations where an opponent for a particular event filed a lawsuit alleging a violation of this particular statute because there was an online presence. And so it puts clients like mine in a position of having to defend against those type of lawsuits.
Okay, so that's, I wondered what the problem was. Mm-hmm. And there's, I finally figured out what the problem is. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Thompson, you're okay?
No, that was a question I was going to ask.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay.
I'm going to close the hearing on 3186.
I'm okay.
You're okay?
Mm-hmm.
Going to open a work session on House Bill 3186. There's no amendments, is there? The Vice Chair moves House Bill 3186 to the floor with a due pass. Any opposition? Seeing none, so moved. Okay, colleagues.
Thank you.
One more step. We got to lose carrier.
Almost
home.
Thank you.
Yeah, I was just trying to figure out what the problem was.
Thank you.
I'll carry that one. Okay. Just for everyone's information again, we're going to carry over House Bill 2832A, House Bill 3414A, House Bill 2567A, House Bill House Bill 3056A, and House Bill 3317A. Colleagues, good job today. We are adjourned.
Good job, Fred.
Okay.
Excellent.
Okay.
Excellent.
Jerk.
Good job.